Winning is an everyday mindset, and on the Ways to Win podcast, coaches Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. Each week, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve off-court problems. They'll talk about the latest news in college and professional basketball with coaches like Jim Boeheim, former players like Stephanie White, basketball analysts like Grant Hill, and more. Revealing insights that made them into the leaders they are today. And don't miss President Obama, sharing how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Go Blue with Stu. I am your host, Stuart Douglas, with me for, the third, fourth, fifth, sixth time, who knows, from The Athletic, Brendan Quinn. Yeah, it's been, I think you're my most popular guest now.
I think I'm just a cheap date, Stu.
Do you know what, though? Cheap dates always turn out the best.
I don't know where you were going to take that, but I can assure you that today probably won't be as fruitful for you, pal.
Well, yeah, that could have gone a number of ways, but I'll tell you what, the fancy stuff never goes well. This mm-hmm. is stuff I enjoy. I think that's a life lesson we learned, to be honest.
True story.
Yeah.
Learn that early.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That enjoy the people you're around, not the stuff that's around you. So you recently, obviously, right for The Athletic, recently you've been getting blown up about this Beilein article you've written, and it's called John Beilein, the Quintessential College Coach and the Lessons He Can't Explain. And it was, I had my buddy text me about it. It was an interesting look. I've tried to explain this to people, like even in college and like with sports in general, like how much luck plays a part in everything we do. And it was interesting to see John not like come to grips with that, but like just really like think about it and think about his career. I was like, oh yeah, all these things do have to fall into place for it to happen. And he's not that type of guy. I think mm-hmm. he's like more of like, all right, we're going to keep pressing forward. We're not going to think too much back besides, you know, yesterday's practice or game. And so I'm curious of like you writing that article and what you thought you were going to get out of him and what you did get out of him and kind of like where he's at now. Was it what you were expecting, quote-wise and like perspective-wise, from him?
No, I mean, for a guy that I've written far too much about, frankly, it takes kind of a lot to be like surprised at this point, you know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if anything, the more surprising thing would be like a total unloading of like, you know, just really like opening a vein up. You know what I mean? Because like that's never gonna probably be him, and that was kind of always the way it is, and it's totally fine. But like where the story came from was, you know, we just talked this summer, and it was like, you know, we weren't talking for a story, we're just talking like normal humans. Mm-hmm. And I knew he was going into the Hall of Fame, and just mentioned something to him like hey, you know, if you want to do something around that, if there's anything you want to talk about, if there's whatever, like, you know, let's reconnect and we can talk, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And so that's kind of really where it came from. As it actually, the Hall of Fame itself kind of snuck up. I was like, oh, you know, shit, it's like a week away or something like that. Like, you know, kind of kick the tires. Like, if you want to do something, we got to do something. And then it was just, you know, I'll call you Friday, and just calls Friday. And, you know, when I asked him, I'm like, you're going into the College Hall of Fame. That it's different. It is different than the Naismith Hall of Fame. It is, you know, kind of the subculture of the basketball culture. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think of yourself as a college coach, what really jumps out to you? And he goes, you know, kind of theme wise, he goes right to building programs and, you know, taking these places that are just completely in shambles and then building them up and moving on is, I think, kind of his marker of like what he did. So it's not really like measured in wins and the Final Fours and NCAA tournament appearances. I think it's this process of like finding something that's broken and fixing it through his neurosis, through his process, through his whatever, right?
Yeah.
But I do think you're right that like in the time of being able to take a step back, you do start to realize like all the things that were probably out of your control way more than you can ever do in the moment. And, you know, a lot of like what he said in this, and it didn't really come from the, like me asking specifically about those jobs. It was, you know, him saying, man, that first Canisius team I had was just incredible. And you know, they put it all together in that second year. And I was just so lucky to get those guys. And then at Richmond, it was the same thing. I was just so lucky that those were the guys that I got there. And then you have to wonder like, well, okay, then the obvious question is, well, what if you didn't get those guys? Or what if you took a different job? Or what if any number of things? Like, he almost didn't take the Richmond job. He turned it down the first time. He told me a story I'd never heard. It didn't make it in the story, so I'll just tell it here. But when Richmond came the first time, so he would have been through 5 years at Canisius, right? Was kind of a name generating interest, I think, generally as a guy who was going to get a job. But after this, at that point in the season, I guess Kathleen's father had just passed. So John's wife, Kathleen, I think her father had just passed. So it was this very kind of emotionally charged time for the family. There's a lot going on, et cetera, et cetera. And then Richmond comes calling, and it was just kind of a, can't do it. There's just too much going on. We're not going to do it.
Yeah.
Legendary Richmond AD Chuck Boone, like kind of did the old, like, let's just put a pin in it. I'll see you at the Final Four. And John kept telling him like, oh, no, it's not happening. And he goes, let's just, you know, we'll catch up at the Final Four. We'll go have a cup of coffee. And then, so John and Kathleen were driving out to the Final Four that year. And talking about it. And I think Kathleen said, like, kind of said that she was at a place that she would be okay with it and blah, blah, blah. But John was more focused on telling Chuck Boone that he was not taking this job. So he's like, you know what? The first rest stop I see in Ohio or in Indiana, I'm going to pull off. I'm going to find a payphone and I'm going to call Chuck and I'm going to tell him I'm not taking the job and that we shouldn't even bother meeting at the Final Four.
Mm.
And so he hits the first exit, and it was Richmond, Indiana was the first exit.
That's
good. And he gets out. And of course, John takes it as some kind of omen, whatever, goes in, gets on the payphone. I'm guessing Chuck up the offer to some larger sum of money, or it made it more enticing, whatever. But he ended up accepting over the phone, basically. And gets back in the car and says, we're moving to Richmond. So, like, all those things that happen, right? Like, who knows? You know, or if he took any of those other jobs. If he took Colgate, or if he got the Colgate job, or if he got the Army job. Like,
yeah,
you just never know.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast.
Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
There was a story I heard about IU, about Indiana, before he took the Michigan job, that essentially it was his. And then there's a miscommunication and they hired Tom Crean.
Yeah.
So it was like, what if Beeline was at IU? Would that have worked? Like with the type of kids, like with that atmosphere? You wrote about it, I don't remember, I think in 19, when they were going through their coaching search, and it was, you said IU burns all the bulbs. They burn out all the bulbs. And it was like, would he have been good in that atmosphere? So it's like a guessing game that you just can never answer. And it's interesting the point you brought up, but he brought up programs, because which it takes the least amount of luck, right? That takes the most work and skill. And it's like, you know, it wasn't making a Final Four or Jordan Poole's shot that propelled them to a national championship game. Like, those weren't his moments, because he knows. I think, you know, those are probably purposeful for, by him. Like, yeah, like, those things just happen. Like, what I did was my legacy, and building up all of that. But yeah, the amount of luck that that takes, like all of it, from players to the who your coaching staff is. I mean, people never talk about that. Like, our success starting my junior year, like, that was the full coaching staff, like, really overhauled everything and what it took to really run a program. It was mind blowing to think about, like, all you see is like head coach and like a couple players that we talk about. It's like,
right,
top to bottom, who you got. I mean, you can have a director of basketball operations guy start ruining kids' minds in the behind the scenes. Like, you don't know what's gonna happen. So it was interesting to just think about it all. But from your perspective, covering him since 2013, you've seen him, I think you really saw him evolve as a coach then, and then you've seen him like retire and go through the troubles with Cleveland, and now he's kind of in a good spot with the Pistons. You know, talking to him person to person,
yeah,
like, how was it this past year, kind of where he's at, and then like, how have you seen that evolve throughout the years? Is there an answer there?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's been interesting, because a part of it's like anything else, where it's, you know, when suddenly when you're A, when you get older, and B, when, you know, like, I imagine you speak to John and other coaches and other people differently than you did, you know, 5-10 years ago, just because you're older, and yeah. I kind of have, you know, a similar thing in general, you know, that it's just kind of the relationships change. And, you know, I don't cover him as a beat writer, and, you know, it's more of a kind of natural conversations. And, you know, John's always, he's a very guarded person. It takes a lot of time to kind of earn trust, which I've always really respected and stuff like that, that there is kind of a degree of now you got to earn it, man. You better put your work in here, you know? And I think the combination of just time and from him, the combination of the time that's passed and realizing that, like, he's not going to be able to change what happened. Like, he's not gonna be able to change the decision that he left Michigan. He's not gonna be able to change what happened in Cleveland. He's not gonna, you know, I think coming to peace with that, like, those were his words, like, I have come to peace with that. And I think as that process has played out, he's probably been more willing to Just talk in general, because, you know, like, I feel like when something goes sideways like that, like, your natural inclination is to think that, like, that's all anyone's going to want to talk about, or like, that's how people, like, that's the lens that they're looking at you through, you know what I mean? And just as you move on from it, it becomes easier to kind of be yourself a little bit more. And I do think a little bit, like, later in life, like, John's probably able to be way more like himself than he was as a coach, where he had to be this super guarded guy. Like, I think you're getting more of, like, the Buffalo version of the dude. You know what I mean? Like, when I, like, have hung out with his old buddies from, like, back in Buffalo, I'm like, those guys are maniacs.
They're nuts.
A bunch of, like, misfits. They're great guys.
Yeah.
Just, like, incredible bullshitters and, like, amazing characters and all that stuff. And when we would only see the kind of, like, buttoned up version of John, you know, I would, like, always have, like, kind of some trouble marrying. I'm like, these are your friends.
Oh yeah.
Wait a second, you know? So I feel like maybe you're getting more of the guy that is, that he really is, as opposed to, like, I'm the head coach at Michigan and no one can see me have a beer in public and blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like,
Oh yeah, my mom used to get so pissed because once a year he would invite all of his Buffalo buddies, and I think he gave them, like, really good tickets to an Ohio State game. I don't remember what it was. And then some of the parents were, like, up high. My mom did not like that whatsoever. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, it's his buddies. It's once a year. And, like, he's the coach. So, like, I kind of understand it. But, yeah, I don't think that happened again after my mom can, like,
Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
You're ready, Bob.
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
I ask you, do you think his relationships have changed with ex-players now that he's not an actual active coach?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I really talked about it on here, but I didn't really talk to him from, like, time I was 23 until, like, the pandemic hit. Like, I didn't talk to him really at all. And he called me, and I'm on the Monon Trail in Indy, and I'm riding my bike, and I'm going through some life events that I'm struggling with. And he called me, and I was like, huh, this is fitting. We just had a normal conversation. And he goes, you know, we should do this more often. I got so many players. Like, he kind of, like, was defending himself. Like, we haven't talked in years, but, like, you know, even if I called one player a week, it wouldn't be enough, blah, 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 kind of that thing. And I was like, you don't have to. I didn't say this. It was like, he didn't have to explain himself. Like, I was never expecting him to do that anyways. But, like, you feel that burden from coaching so many people. I mean, he's got so many people always wanting to talk to him. Coaches, in the article you wrote, coaches calling him about advice about building up a program. So I think he's been able to take a step back and reach out more. I mean, we're putting together a weekend where my team and the surrounding years are going to go to a football game next year. They're presenting or honoring the 2013 Final Four team Michigan State at Michigan this year in February. I'm going to be at that. And we've been in communications. He actually just started up a group text with some of our guys, like, a few days ago. That was the first time we've ever done that. So it is cool to see that a little bit. And I always had a unique relationship with him and my college experience in general. That's taken me time to sit back and reflect on and be like, oh yeah, this is nice to have these relationships.
Right.
And you know, you divorce yourself from all the emotions of playing and being a part of a program. Like, it's draining, and it's amazing. Yeah. To your point with him getting farther away from the Cleveland thing, certain people recharge at different moments and at different time spans, and you got to separate yourself for a while. And some people are like, all right, I got over it. I had a quick therapy session. I'm good to go. We're good to go. And some people are like, yeah, you just need 3 years to build that back up and be like, all right, I want these relationships. I want to get back into Michigan basketball. Like, I've just started to become like a fan of Michigan basketball, like in the past 2 or 3 years. Like, I never really was, because I was so separated from it. So it's fun to see that, and it's fun to see him kind of connect, for us to have that connection. And yeah, we'll see where it goes. But yeah, he's definitely like turned a page that way. But
right,
it's interesting to see. You do things you never expect. You just like, you can't foresee all these things.
Yeah, and like when you think about his past, like you use the word recharging, which is, I think, pretty apt. Like, one of the things that sticks out to me about him is, so look at it this way. So he had the LeMoyne job for whatever it was, like 8-9 years, right? So he got the Canisius job in 92, and he was like 39 or 40. So like, that's how old I am now, right?
Yeah.
And so like, I try to think of how exhausting it would be to like do like the rebuild thing. Like, that sounds like a young man thing, like, you know, 30 years old, 25 years old, whatever. And I'm sure John and other coaches would laugh and be like, you're young, you're 40, right? But like, I'm tired.
Yeah,
like, you're getting up there a little bit, my man.
Oh, yeah.
Like, like the idea of doing what he like continued to do when he did it, to me, just seems brutal. And I asked him that, like, so, okay, if he got Canisius when he was 39, that means 5 years later, he got Richmond. So he would have been 44-ish. So then it would have been going to West Virginia 5 years after that, rebuilding that program. And then 5 years after that, going to Michigan and rebuilding that. Like, one thing I asked him was, like, at any point were you like, I don't feel like doing this again. I'm just going to stay here. And all these phone calls I'm getting, I'm just going to be like, no, I'm staying at West Virginia, or I'm staying at Richmond. I'm just going to build this thing out. I'm just going to happily be the coach here for 30 years because I don't feel like starting over. And he said, yes, that he did feel that way and that he did think about that. But it was his like natural place. And I think there was an underlying concern that he had brought places to success that weren't totally sustainable.
That's
got to be a thing as a coach, when it's like, you take Canisius to the NCAA tournament, okay, man, well, you're not, that's it, like, you're not gonna go to a Final Four at Canisius. Or, you know, like, if you get to Richmond and you pull off the big upset in the tournament, right? That's it, man. Like, you're probably not going to do much better. So I feel like he would take these places to these heights and then kind of have that sinking feeling of like, oh my God, like, can I keep doing this here? And then which in hindsight is really interesting when you think about Michigan and how, like, what was going on inside that head, you know, from 13 to 15, when he goes to the Final Four. And then, you know, 2 years later, that was a 500 team. And yeah, there were injuries and extenuating circumstances, but like, the people were already talking like, oh man, that, you know, Trey Burke took Michigan to the Final Four, not Joe Bielan. You know, like, you were already hearing it. And like, I do wonder if there were any thoughts in there of like, might be time to go, you know, like, I did my 5-year thing, but maybe I should bounce. And instead, you know, why Michigan is the outlier in his career is that he didn't leave and took him back to the Final Four in 18. And, you know, who knows what would have happened if he stayed.
I think that's, to me, that was his biggest accomplishment.
The second Final Four.
Yeah, from a program standpoint, where it was like, no, we're going to charge ahead. We're doing it the right way. We don't have all the NBA guys like we did in 13. That doesn't matter. And to prove that you could do it that way again, like, that was a big deal. But I've told a story a few times, or like just talked about it. It's not really a story, but he was on the hot seat my junior year, apparently. And I had no idea until like I graduated and the media was like, oh yeah, like, people were calling for his head. I'm like, I was worried about the next clip mistake I made on film. Like, I couldn't even think of a fathom that. And I was like, because the whole time, I didn't think he was doing a bad job. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you should keep the job or that you're good enough for it. But we were like, nothing had changed from my freshman year, which was funny. Like, we were doing the same things. We had just changed coaching staffs my junior year, and we were just doing like the exact same thing. And like, eventually, I mean, we had a coming to Jesus moment as a team, changed that whole season around, and then that whole trajectory just sent off. But I mean, he was doing the same stuff over and over, and it, but it is, it's like that Harbaugh effect, right? It's like, he had it in the NFL. He had his first time in Stanford and definitely in the NFL. You know, they loved him. He went out with a ball fire. He went to the Super Bowl, and then players were like, can't stand this guy. We got to move on. Yeah. Like, they captured a moment, they captured a feeling, they captured an energy. And then like withstanding an energy, like dealing with a guy for 4 years is a long time.
Yeah,
it is a long time. So college basketball is perfect for those types of situations. Like, you, it's so different, I feel like, for NBA guys. Like, you got to be Phil Jackson. You got to be people person. In college basketball, like, you can. You can just capture a moment with a guy and be like, this is your snapshot of 4 years. We're going to do this in your 4 years. So I'm kind of rambling here, but it is interesting to look at how he was able to stay at Michigan. But that Michigan job was completely different for him. It was like, that was supposed to be the final spot. And I remember them talking the first couple of years. I talked with some coaches or like people, media, whoever, like, that was supposed to be his final spot. And he didn't know what to do with it at first. He was like, how do I recruit? Like, people want to come here. This doesn't make any sense. I have to offer a 16-year-old kid. Like, what do you mean? And it was like, if you want to build a program you want to stay at, you got to do these things like a Duke and a Kansas. You got to do all these things a little different. So it was, it was quite the journey for him. I don't know if he ever talked about that from your time, 13, till you retired, or till you moved on from Michigan at all, in terms of like how he built up the program that way since he got there, in terms of like how he viewed it.
Not that I recall. I don't, maybe we talked about it. I mean, because anytime you would talk about it as a job or as a program, all it was just how great Michigan is. And now it's just this, right? And it's just the hard sell all the time. And you're like, I get it. I know.
Yeah, it's fine.
But like, I do remember being in his office after like Harbaugh got hired, right? And it was just like, you know, Michigan football was just getting all the attention in the world. It was Harbaugh all the time. And I was in his office one day, and I'm like, you're just loving this because nobody cares about you or basketball or any of this. And he was like, it's great. This is perfect. Like, that was his ideal. It's just like, I'm the best, like being like basically, you know, the basketball coach at Canisius, like that level of attention, but with the money and the assets and all the stuff that Michigan has at its disposal, but with the attention of the Canisius coach. Like, that's what he wanted to somehow be able to marry those two things.
It's more fun to be the underdog. That's for sure.
But like, you know, the point of the luck thing, I think, is what really is what sticks with me. Like, your team coming together and changing the entire trajectory of his time at Michigan is like, those are the I'm, as a storyteller, like, those are the things I'm just fascinated by, in terms of like deconstructing history and like what would have happened. And but like, I love all that crap, right? And it's like, when you talk to these old coaches, it's not just Beeline, it's all these guys and women who have, you know, led teams and had these 10 years and stuff like that. Those pivotal moments are just like embedded in their minds of like those, like, what if that game had gone differently, and you don't know where they are. And but like, so when we talked for this story, he was walking down Rodeo Drive drinking coffee because the Pistons were out there. So he's walking down Rodeo Drive complaining about the price of the coffee that he's drinking, and we're talking about these kind of flashbulb moments. And he goes back to, I think I mentioned it in the story, the Richmond game at Marist, which I had never heard of. He's never mentioned it to me, blah, blah, blah. But he started talking about this game that was in 1989. And, or was it that early? I don't know. Whenever the hell it was. He started talking about this game as if it were like last week.
Yeah.
It was incredible. He's like, we had just lost to Western Michigan. We were off to a slow start. We got pantsed in the first half. We're losing by 18 or whatever at Marist. And I'm thinking to myself, like, this is it. Like, the whole thing is coming undone. Like, we might not make it.
Yeah.
So he's having, like, an existential crisis going into halftime at Marist. Like, am I going to lose this job? Is my career over? Whatever. And, like, he didn't make any coaching adjustment. He just went in and was just like, guys, we got to turn this thing around. And, yeah. And his group of 19 and 20-year-olds were like, just turned into a bunch of shit kickers, suddenly went out and outscored Marist by 20 points in the second half, went on, had a decent year, made the tournament one more time, like a year later, whatever. He got the West Virginia job 2 years after that. But then he's like, well, what happened if the Marist game didn't? Like, that's just crazy to me.
I know. It's crazy to me when people mention that with my team in the Michigan State game. Like, and I'm like, I don't know. I feel like we still could have made the tournament losing that game. Because, like, in my mind, we were doing all the right things, you know? And I think I even said that, like, after the game, like, people, you know, it was a huge deal for everyone, right? And I'm like, after the game, I was like, I think, you know, even if we lost, we made big strides. And I feel like people, like, thought I was an idiot for saying that. Like, because obviously it's a win-lose situation. Yeah. But yeah, in my mind, he was just always one foot in front of the other, and it was just going to work out. You do the right things, and it was going to work out. And my parents had taught me that early on, and he just obviously took that to a whole new level and a whole different situation. So I was like, yeah, you just, I don't know, you figure it out. Like, it'll figure itself out. You do the right things. So it's funny to reflect on, like, the small details, because you could do it over and over again. But
yeah.
Where was I going to finish this? I had a thought. I don't know. I'm all out of thoughts. BQ.
Too early. AM podcasting is always a dangerous proposition. I've noticed myself.
Yeah. It's, well, podcasting in general, especially when you get me and if I ramble for over a minute and you just like, where was I going with this again? But yeah, it's fun.
You think he gets into Naismith?
That part I don't know. My dad asked me about the college one. I'm like, oh, definitely. Like, that was no brainer. Naismith. I've been confused about the Naismith before. So, we'll see. But I'm curious if the zero national championships hurts him a little bit.
It's tough.
Yeah, that'll be tough. But when is that determination if he's in the field?
I don't know. I mean, he still has to get, like, I think on the official ballot too.
Right. So there's a whole process for that. Yeah. Did he talk about that?
No.
Yeah. Did you ask him?
I don't think so. And there's just, like, things that, you know, like, I've talked to John enough, both as, like, a pedestrian and as a reporter, where, like, you know, he's not going to sit there and be like, yes, it would mean a lot to me to get in the Naismith. He would never say that out loud. I don't think. In his mind, I think it would be massive. But
yeah, isn't that funny? He's, like, in a spot where he's, like, trying to be accepting. Like, you get older and you're trying to be accepting your whole career, and then there's still that one thing hangs over your head, and you got to say, I'll be fine without it. And then it happens, and these grown men are just sobbing, and they're like, and it's like, yeah, you really wanted that one, didn't you?
Yeah, right. You're like, you're so full of it, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's funny how that works. But that's life. You just got to, like, fake it till you make it, as Nancy Douglas.
Yeah. It was, I mean, it was fun to write it. It's been a minute. The last time I wrote about John was, you know, when the kind of the floor came out in Cleveland, and I didn't even, you know, obviously didn't talk to him, but so it was nice to write him about him again. It was, I was joking with my friends last night, like, you remember that LCDC or what? I'm having a glitch. LCD sound system. Thank you.
Okay.
You know, their final show was like, Shut Up and Play the Hits. That's what it felt like here. It's like, you know, just,
yeah,
when in doubt, you know, we got a Black Friday sale, go tap the Beeline well and see what stories.
Let it write itself. It'll come to be not too bad. But yeah, Zoom is about to kick us off in 30 seconds. And I cannot stand to do this again with these podcasts. I have just been piecing some of these together. My producer's gonna kill me. But BQ, I appreciate you. We'll have to get you back on and talk some actual Michigan basketball.
Would love that.
And I got to ask you about golf one of these days. So we'll get you back on. But yeah,
all for it, my man. All right.
Sounds good.